If you believe assault is an act, not an adjective, your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. What do you believe? Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443. That was me on guitar. That's what I'm talking about right there. Yeah. Yeah, that was me. Okay. So, good morning, everybody. How are you? Wanted to talk with you a little bit about ammunition today. Ammunition has been very hard to come by in the last year. In the last year and a half, it's been pretty hard to come by. Of course, Obama and his regime happen to be the biggest salespeople of guns and ammo. You can thank them for this huge influx in the entire industry because people are concerned about them doing whatever backdoor way or even front door attempt at taking away guns and ammo. So one of the options to buying ammo, which is very expensive now, is to hand load or reload ammo, which has been very popular over the years. So I am not by any means a master reloader, but I do hand load some rounds. It's kind of the difference between hand loading and reloading. Hand loading is all new components. Reloading is when you're reusing the brass. You can't reuse any other component. The four main components, you've got the brass, you've got the brass casing, you've got the primer, the powder, and the bullet. The primer, the powder and the bullet are all dispensable. The only thing you can reuse is the brass. So, especially when we're talking about rifle ammunition of some sort of odd caliber, something that's not very common, it's getting a lot harder to find, even new. Why, might you ask? Well, because the ammunition manufacturers have to deal with the people that make the brass. Now, some ammo manufacturers make their own brass, and of course, they also will sell just the brass. They're not making the odd calibers nearly as much as they used to because people are buying up all of the common calibers as fast, if not faster, than they can actually produce them. So you're not going to find the 458 lot out there very easily right now. 4570 is a little difficult to come by. The 222 Remington is not going to be available like the 223 Remington, which is what you're going to fire through an AR-15. Just some of these odder calibers, you're not able to find the brass components for. And I say brass, they're actually brass with nickel plating on some of them. I kind of like those to a point. Anyhow, it's just getting more and more difficult to find the components. It's hard to find primers nowadays. When powder comes up on any particular internet website, it's gone in 2 or 3 days. You really have to be on it pretty much every day, a couple times a day, if you're looking for the components. Now, that's provided you actually know how to load. So we're going to go through a little bit of just some of the intel that I've got when it comes to hand loading. Some of the things to look out for. There are some health concerns. So I'm going to inform you of said health concerns, and hopefully you will heed the proper precautions. All right. So we're going to hit that when we come back from this break coming up. So stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is live. 1-800-313-9443. welcome back. So we're talking a little bit about ammunition, specifically right now reloading, hand loading. Now, a lot of people, when they shoot handgun ammunition, will load just bare lead rounds. They're not jacketed. Now, the way most bullets are made are you have a lead core with a copper jacketing. Now, depending on what sort of jacketing that is, depends on what it's called. If it completely encapsulates the things, there's a full metal jacket. There's also the total metal jacket. There's blah, blah, blah. The thing is there's a lead core with copper on the outside. Why lead? Well, lead deforms when it hits something. Why a copper jacket? Well, lead can cause health problems and can also cause some issues in the guns with lead fouling down the bore. And the copper is a little bit harder than lead. However, the jacket is generally rather thin, so it will go in, the copper will start to deform, and then the lead itself will also deform and become kind of a more wadded up ball. It will increase the size of the caliber in effect. And it won't necessarily over-penetrate and pierce through solid steel. So that's why we have a lead core followed by a copper jacketing in most bullets. Some people prefer to practice with just a bare lead bullet. Okay? We're going to talk about that a little bit. You can buy bare lead bullets, and some people actually cast them on their own. It's not just lead. There's some other additives in there. Exactly what it is, I don't know, because I don't do it. A lot of the people that shoot the cowboy action will shoot bare lead. Some people that will shoot the steel plate challenges will also shoot bare lead. Now, lead is a very soft metal. You have a steel barrel with rifling that actually deforms the bullet just a little bit as it goes through the barrel. If you're deforming lead, what you're going to do is shave some of that lead off of the bullet and leave little bits of it in the barrel. After a while, if you don't clean that out, you need to clean it pretty often. We're talking, I wouldn't shoot more than 50 to 100 rounds in a handgun without cleaning it if I was shooting bare lead. I would probably at least do a bore snake with a little bit of solvent, like do some solvent and then finish with a bore snake after 50 rounds, maybe 100. But that changes the compression in the barrel. It changes the pressures involved. So it can lead to a little bit of dangers. To a little bit of a dangerous situation. So, here are, just so you understand, if you're going to deal with the bare lead, some of the toxic effects of lead are pretty well documented, both children and adults. Okay, lead can, people who are exposed to lead, you have to realize it can damage the central nervous system, the cardiovascular system, reproductive system, the hematological system, and kidneys. Okay, workers' lead exposure, when you talk about people that work in different foundries and things that deal with lead, can also harm development of their children when they bring lead dust home in their clothing. So if you have it around in your house, you can have the same effect. Lead's been shown to be a carcinogen in animals and suggested in adults. And authors of recent studies suggest that occupational lead exposure and exposure from those who use it quite a bit in hand loading of ammunition increase the risk of cancer. All right? Lead poisoning often goes undetected because many of the symptoms, such as stomach pain, headaches, anxiety, irritability, poor appetite, and they're kind of nonspecific and may be recognized as symptoms of other issues, not just lead poisoning. Now, how do you find out what your lead levels are? You'll get a simple blood test. It's real easy. As a matter of fact, your dentist can order it. So you can just go get a very simple blood test done and say, look, I want to have my blood test look for heavy metals, including lead. Now, when I worked a lot at the shooting ranges, and I was out there, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, 45 weeks a year, I would have my blood level checked, usually once a year, sometimes every other year. And luckily for me, because these were outdoors, it wasn't bad. And also where I was working, they would tend to mine the berms, meaning that they would actually go in there with heavy equipment during the downtime and actually get all of the lead out of the berms. And the guy that happened to be in charge of getting all of the lead out of the berms was, well, pretty ingenious. What he would do is he would take a bunch of the lead that he got, and he'd get a bunch of steel bread pans, and he would put a bunch of the lead that had been fired in these steel bread pans and melt it down over a very hot propane stove of sorts that he would put together. And you'd end up with a block of lead. It was about 35 pounds in the shape of a bread pan. So it looked much like a tapered brick. Well, I got one of these because I like to use that block, that lead block. And I don't use lead for any sort of reloading or hand loading. I just don't do it. I when I sit at my reloading bench, it's for caliber-specific rifle stuff. 308, 22 250, let's see, 416 Remington Magnum. I have some stuff, let's see, 30-30 Winchester. And I have yet to do it, but I have some stuff available for 8mm Lebel rifle and 7.5mm Swiss, the old Schmidt-Rubin. So I am very caliber-specific on what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. With that being said, I keep that lead block around for when I need to tap on a gun to get a pin in or out, make some sort of a small adjustment, because it ends up being a non-galling surface. If I need to lay a gun or a gun part down and smack it or tap it with something, it goes on top of the block of lead. Also, in reloading, you have these kinetic bullet pullers. Now, there's bullet pullers that go onto presses, but there's also a kinetic bullet puller. It looks a lot like a hammer. And you put a round in there, tighten this thing down, and you end up smacking it on a hard surface. Well, I find this lead block to be the ideal hard surface to smack the bullet puller on, because a bullet puller is made, what you're smacking it is a very, very hard plastic. And if you end up smacking that thing on something really hard like concrete, You can't do it on carpet. There's too much give. You don't want to do it on tile. The tile might break. If you do it on concrete, eventually that bullet puller might break. Now, I have a couple of them just in case one does break. But I smack it on the big lead block because that's a hard enough surface to get the bullet puller to unseat that round. But it's also soft enough not to cause a bunch of excess damage to the bullet puller by smacking it onto a really hard surface. Okay, so keep in mind, if you're going to deal with lead, you are probably going to have issues. That big lead block that I've got, I have a very large laundry room, and I have the machines on one side. On the back wall, what I've got is I've got a large countertop, and I've got a big utility sink. Inside the countertop, I have routed out a spot for one of these 5-gallon parts washers. In that 5-gallon parts washer, I have a cleaning solution for guns. I don't clean parts with it. I clean guns in it and gun parts. And what I keep in there is M-Pro 7, because M-Pro 7 is a water-soluble cleanser. It's non-carcinogenic. It's just good. And it cleans carbon. Now, that black soot left around on guns, especially you AR-15 shooters and you guys that shoot handguns a lot, you will know what carbon's all about. That's the thing that builds up a lot and you want to get rid of it. It's essentially the ashes left over from when you burn most powders. You know, you burn a campfire, you end up with ash. When you burn gunpowder, you end up with carbon. So it's very difficult to get rid of carbon unless you have the right stuff. M-Pro 7 works fantastic. I once bought a 5-gallon bucket of that stuff, and in my parts washer, I keep about a gallon and a half in there, and probably once a year, maybe twice a year sometimes, if I'm shooting and cleaning a lot, I need to filter that stuff out, but that's what I keep in the parts washer. Also, on this long table, that's where I keep the big lead brick, and I keep it wrapped up in a... it's not really a terry cloth thing. It's kind of a combination between it's like a chamois, kind of a combination between a terry cloth and a paper towel that I keep covered over that block. So when I use it and I actually smack it on what is essentially this this kind of a chamois of sorts. So that way I don't have this big block of exposed lead around. Not that that's really going to have any sort of issue, but, you know, what the heck. Again, I'm not a tree hugger, but I'll give a tree a high five as I pass by through the woods as I've got my gun on me because I'm going back there to shoot and kill something, take it back home and eat it. So that's how I feel about the whole woodsy thing. But, I mean, I don't want to have myself exposed to anything more than necessary. And if I put a little sort of chamois over that lead block serves its purpose, and I'm not directly exposed to the thing. Not like it's kryptonite or something, but still, just the way I look at it. So be careful if you're dealing with lead. All right, exposed lead, especially if you're casting your own bullets, there are a lot of precautions you need to take into effect, because otherwise you might not die from a lead bullet directly. You just very well might, I guess, shorten your lifespan by dealing with the lead bullets that you're casting indirectly. So take a lot of caution, and maybe even think twice about it, but take a lot of caution with it. So stay tuned, folks. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
All right, guys, so the main ignition source when you have a piece of ammunition, the primary ignition source, is the primer. Now, the primer is a dangerous little bad boy by itself. I don't know if you've ever seen a primer or heard a primer or watched a primer go off by itself, but it is a pretty explosive little object. You would be quite surprised in seeing what that tiny little bad boy will do when stricken. And, you know, people use these just the primer to do what they call fire-forming a casing sometimes. You'll take a primer, maybe a little bit of powder, and kind of stuff a wad of sorts inside the neck of the casing, put it into the gun that you're going to use it with, and then press the trigger in a safe direction and fire form the chamber. What that does is it makes the round, the brass casing, it makes the casing fit to the chamber so that you have I guess you can load up a more precise round because now everything's fit specifically to the chamber of that gun. I don't care how many guns you get a Remington Model 700 PSS 308 and you take 1,000 of them and all of the chambers are going to be slightly different, especially over time. So what you would end up doing is if you fire a casing out of a certain rifle, what you can do is you can just neck size that rifle case. You don't have to full-length size it. Just neck size it if it's going to go through the same rifle. Now, I have some brass. I have a couple different 308s, and I have some brass for one of my 308s and some brass for the other one for a couple of reasons. The really, really excellent high-end brass that I've got, I keep in for my precision gun. The other stuff will go to my other 308, which I use as a hunting gun, because pretty much any brass is good enough for that if I do my job in hand-loading, reloading those rounds. And I also don't have to go through the full-on process of full-length sizing these casings. I can just use a neck sizer. And then these rounds are good for this gun. These rounds are good for that gun. Now, luckily enough for me, if one of those guns goes down or I need to use the rounds for the other one, each of those rounds, like the rounds for my precision gun, will also go into my hunting gun. And the rounds for my hunting gun will also go in my precision gun. I'm lucky that way that even just doing neck sizing of pre-fired casings will swap between rifles. So if I need to use it in a pinch, I can. But otherwise, it's pretty well set up specifically. Each gun has its own duty, and I load ammunition for those duties separately, and I mark them that way. I keep them separated out. Back to the primers. These primers, the job is the striker or firing pin or hammer, whatever you've got in your gun, hits that primer with a lot of force and with a very fairly sharp point. It's blunt to a degree, but yet it comes to a point. And it hits that primer, which causes that primer to essentially fire. It kind of explodes. That firing that it does goes in and it ignites all of the powder that's in the casing. That powder begins to burn, building up gases. Those gases launch the bullet out of the rifle, out of the casing, through the chamber, down the barrel, and out the muzzle, and downrange towards target. So that's really the way that this whole deal works. And again, so then the primer's a one-use item. It's done. The bullet is downrange, getting mangled. It's a one-use item. And the powder gets burned up, so you can only reuse the casing. These primers need to be handled with care. Don't go dumping them into big old trays and leaving them there. Leave them in their factory packages. All right? Use them, then put them away. If you end up needing to deprime, let's say that you're loading some stuff up and you make some kind of a mistake. Like one time I forgot to neck size my casings. I did all the prep, had neglected to neck size them because I wasn't following my checklist or I checked it incorrectly. I don't remember exactly what was going on. But the thing is now I had about 50 casings that had primers in them, but they hadn't been sized yet. So I needed to deprime the casings with live primers. Okay, keep in mind, they can go off. I have not had it happen, but I haven't deprimed a bunch of them. The most cases I've deprimed is maybe, I don't know, 400 or 500 casings when I was recirculating some old military brass that had cracked on the neck. So wear hearing protection, wear eye protection, if not a full face shield, and very gently deprime these things. How do I do it? I don't use a sizing die when I deprime. What I use is I use a specific depriming die. It's just for depriming. It doesn't size or anything. Because if one goes off while I'm depriming it, I don't want to get any of the case lube that I may need to use on the case inside the primer and make it unusable. And if one does go off, I don't want it to go off inside of a sizing die and potentially cause any harm or fouling to it. So I use a depriming die specifically. All right? So just be very, very careful with these primers. I have seen them go off. They are difficult little bad boys to have to deal with if they do. They will definitely get your attention if they go off. You can probably go on YouTube. There used to be a couple of videos of this, of primers going off when people were hand loading. I don't know if they're still up, but check it out. Be very careful with the primers. All right? That's my advice to you. Stay tuned, guys. There's plenty more show to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, and welcome back. So we've been talking about ammunition. Now what I want to talk about, it has to do with ammunition storage. Let's say you've got all your ammo, you've bought it or you've loaded it or whatever. How, where, what are you going to do about ammunition storage? So keep this in mind. When the military does their ammunition, they want it to be able to last any place for any period of time. So they will literally seal the primer and where the bullet goes into the casing, usually with some sort of a liquid, some sort of a lacquer of sorts, over the primer and around the bullet. You don't need to do that. Why do they do it? So they can store it pretty much anywhere. The reason being, what is most susceptible to going bad is the powder followed by the components inside the primer that cause it to spark and ignite. So, a cool place that is not high in humidity. Now, some people would be inclined to dig a big hole in their backyard and have some sort of underground bunker for their ammunition. Okay, if you want to do that, fine. Just absolutely fill the thing with deci packs and change them out every year because it's going to get moist down there. I don't care what part of the country you're in unless you're in the desert. I happen to be in the desert. I can build that in my backyard. That's not what I choose to do, however. So if you're going to store this stuff, I tell you, one of the common things to do is just get like those gorilla racks or even the racks that you would see in like a restaurant that are kind of a stainless steel or chrome or stainless steel, and they're on wheels and they're wire racks, pretty heavy duty. That's actually what I have. And you have those things. You can put them in your house. You can put them in your garage, probably a better place. The thing is, you want to store ammunition to where it's accessible to you, but not easily stealable. Okay? I mean, if it's in your house gets broken into, okay, fine. But you don't want somebody just to walk in and grab your stuff and go. So I have these sorts of racks in my garage, but my garage is pretty well secured. It only operates off of a remote control, which is, I happen to have one of these ones that is randomly changing remote controls, plus the garage is alarmed. So I am pretty secure. Plus, I also live in a cul-de-sac in a newer golf course community. I mean, the community's only been there for maybe 4 years, 5 years, something like that. And I live in a cul-de-sac. There's only two houses beyond me. So people don't have a need to be on my street. I'm far enough down the street as well. So I've got a pretty secure home in a pretty secure area, and I've got these racks in my garage, and I have done extra security on my garage. That's where I keep the majority of my ammunition. Not all of it, but it's where I keep my like the cases and such. And those cases I keep, those cases and ammo cans, I keep by caliber. And then by style. All right? So let's say that I have 223 or 5.56 millimeter, right? I have the 223 in one area. I have the 5.56, which would work both in my gun, next to it. So I have one separated from the other. I also have them separated by weights. So here's the 55-grain stuff. Here's the 62-grain stuff. Okay? So that's the way I do it, and that's the way I keep it. When it comes to my shotgun stuff, I've got all of my bird shot in one area, like the 6.5 to 8 shot. I have all of that over in one area. I have all my buckshot in another area, and I have all of my slugs in another area. They're all together, but I have them separated out. Cases and ammo cans, and usually I will keep some ammo cans available in case I want to go to the range. I don't have to take a case and go out there and deal with all the trash. I've already pre-dealt with that. I can grab an ammo can and go. And the ammo can is labeled. How do I label? I just take duct tape and a Sharpie and write what's on it and put that across the top and then on the little front handle so I can see it from either the top or the front of the can. Because I'm going to be able to see one or the other. At least I should be able to. So that's the way I do that. And like all of my 308, I have a bunch of different 308. I have all of my 308 together for the most part. However, I keep those in different styles and grains. Like I have the factory loaded like hunting type ammo. I have the factory loaded target ammo. I have the military surplus stuff. And I have it by weight and style of bullet. All right. I also keep, like, in my room that I have a separate bedroom, which is just, it's the man cave is what it is. I've got my satellite radio in there. I've got my TV hooked up with a satellite in there, and I've got my reloading bench. I've got a little couch in there that also folds out into a futon. It's kind of where I can go in and do gun-type stuff, reloading, whatever it is. Essentially, it's my reloading room. And nobody else has any reason to ever go in there at any time for whatever reason. It's just, it's kind of like my little room. And I don't spend much time there. It's in the back of the house. So sometimes I'll go a week without actually walking down to that part of the house. I have no real need to. I shouldn't say I go a week. I'm down there looking around my house all the time, but I don't really do anything down there unless I'm going to go down there and reload. So in there, I also have a dresser. In that dresser, in the different drawers, I have different ammo and different calibers. So where I have my .308, I have that in there too, and that's where I keep some of my specialty rounds, not my grab to the range and go. These are some specialty rounds. And when I mean specialty rounds, I'm talking like I have some 165 grain all copper bullets that are loaded up. They're the Barnes TSX, I think is what they are. The Barnes TSX in 165 grain. I have, I think, 50 or 100 of those. And I also have the, I think I have 50 of those. I also have the same thing, but in a 200 grain. So those are different specialty type loads. I also have some lighter weight 155 grain ballistic tip, which would be really good for antelope. I think I've got like 50 or 100 of those. I've got those back there. So just different specialty, specific purpose designed ammo that I've got, I keep back there. I keep the majority of my 30-30 in that room. I don't tend to keep that out in the garage. I have some out in the garage, but I keep some in my reloading room as well in that dresser. So the thing is both of these areas are dry, not susceptible to moisture, and not susceptible to extreme temperatures one way or another because my garage is also insulated. Now, of course, the garage is hotter than the house in the summer and colder than the house in the winter. But we don't have. I don't have these dramatic temperature swings to where it's going to otherwise, I guess, cause ill effect to the ammunition. So if you happen to have an area which is a little moist or gets really extreme temperature shifts, if it freezes where you keep your ammunition, if it gets to the point where you could light a match on the shelf because it gets so hot in there, things to be concerned about, all right? If you, now, of course, underground is a nice, good temperature area, but it's also susceptible to moisture. So if you have an underground shed or underground bunker or something on your property where you keep your ammunition underground, that's fine. However, you need to have moisture protection in there, like a moisture barrier. Some people have things made out of cinder block or concrete. That's fine. Put one of those moisture barriers up or coat it with that moisture barrier coating that you can get. It goes on like paint. And try to keep the moisture to an absolute minimum, especially if you also keep guns in there. Now, with guns, you can oil them up. That's great. But keep in mind, if you happen to have a corrosive primer, that's a primer that leaves some sort of generally mercury or some other sort of foreign substance in your gun that can cause corrosion. If you look at Jim Carmichael's book, The Book of the Rifle, finest book ever written by anybody dealing with any kind of firearms, The Book of the Rifle by Jim Carmichael. It's out of print, but you can find it on Amazon.com. If you don't have a copy, go find a copy. It is fantastic. Jim tells a story about his rifle. I think it was a 30-06 when he was a kid. And that thing was just ultimately accurate. Absolutely ultimately accurate. He loved it. He would take this thing. He would target shoot with the thing. He would shoot squirrels. He would go hunting with it. It was his companion, his best friend. And one time when he was growing up, I think he was growing up in the Midwest somewhere, and there was just a really, really rainy week for about 5 days. He couldn't go out and go shooting. When the rain was over, it was time to go out and go shooting. So he grabs his gun, looks down the barrel, and it's absolutely toasted. I mean, it's pitted because he had either corrosive powder or corrosive primers, and he didn't clean the gun. And when the humidity came, all that corrosion took effect to the point where it just ate away his fantastic gun. His rifle was done with, never to be fired again. And of course, he's crushed. And of course, you know, many years later, as he's writing this book, he recalls how he was crushed, still reeling the effects from this. So keep in mind, that sort of stuff needs to stay out of your guns. Keep in mind it's also in some of your ammunition. If you have some of the older stuff or things that are loaded overseas, you don't really have to worry about corrosive primers and corrosive powders and such in the States from different ammunition that's made here. But some of the stuff that's shipped in here, old military surplus type of things, you need to be very careful of that. Make sure after you shoot that, you clean your gun. And also ensure that when you store that ammunition, that if it's too moist, it may get to the point to where it's unusable. A single round of ammunition that is unusable due to storage concerns is unacceptable. You need to store your ammo responsibly. All right? So keep it away from moisture. Keep it to where the temperature doesn't have huge swings, hot or cold. Try to keep your ammunition from freezing temperatures, because that can change up a little bit when it comes to some of the way that some of the powders are made. You know, you've got ball powder, you've got flake powder, you've got the extruded powder, which is kind of a long tube of sorts. It's like a paper towel tube inside of a larger paper towel tube connected with little, straight connectors between tubes. That's kind of what extruded powder is. Stick powder, they also call it. That's a little bit less susceptible to some of the temperature shifts, but flake powder and ball powder is a little bit more susceptible to this. You also have to be careful when you're, I had a project, I've talked about it some time ago on the show, where I ended up with a bunch of 1973 Lake City 308, 7.62x51, what have you. And the cases, the necks on the cases were cracked. Several hundred of these things. Well, I was a little ticked. I bought this stuff. I got it at an auction. I got it for a song, but I got this stuff, and I wanted to be able to use it. Well, as it turns out, I had a whole bunch of other once-fired mil-spec casings. Now, military-spec casings, the brass, is generally thicker than the casings that you're going to get for just regular sporting use. That's going to change the dynamics when you load these things with how much powder is in there. So I had a bunch of mil-spec casings that were loaded ammunition that had split necks, which were totally useless, and a bunch of once-fired mil-spec casings that had the thicker walls. So what I did was and a lot of mil-spec casings are difficult to deprime. I was able to deprime some of them there was no way I was going to get the thing deprimed. I would have had to come up with some sort of hydraulic ram to get them out. Anyhow, I full-length sized a few hundred casings, pulled all of these other rounds apart, kept the bullets, kept the powder, kept the primers. I deprimed these casings that had been split. And the thing is I actually pulled almost all these apart by hand. The bullets were so loose, I could literally pull the bullets out. So I ended up reusing all of this stuff. Now, the trick was how much powder was coming out of each casing. I knew I was going to reload the same things. I didn't really need to know what the powder was. It was extruded powder, the stick powder. But I really didn't need to know so much what it was as to how much came out of each case. So about every 10 cases, I would weigh it, and I would write that number down. After I had a few hundred of these out, I mean, I had about, 40 different measurements. So I had an average of how much powder was supposed to go back in. I had all of that powder. As it turns out, I was loading to that of an IMR 4895 or a Hodgdon 4895. Very, very similar powders, very similar loads. And that was also IMR and Hodgdon both contracted, or had contracts with the companies with Lake City that were loading all of this ammunition at the time. So I was able to use that stuff, and as it turned out, loaded all that stuff up. When I was done, I crimped the case necks around the cantilevers of the bullet. That's on some bullets you end up having this ridge that's on there. These particular ridges on these bullets, 147 grain mil-spec bullets, the ridges were it's kind of like the edge of a quarter. All right, you had a little bit of a surface to it. So that's how far deep I set them. I took all the measurements before I started taking these things apart, and then I reloaded them just with different casings. And a lot of the cases, they came out of Lake City casings, 1973, that were the cases, the necks were not annealed. They were not softened, so they cracked over time. I reloaded them, the majority of them, in once fired Lake City casings, so they came out to the same specs. Some of them went in GG&G casings and a couple others, but all still mil-spec, NATO-spec casings. That's the way I put it all back together. Now, that was a project, and I had to be very, very aware of what I was doing, and I had to be very, very aware of how these things needed to get put back together. So, keeping all of that in mind, if you ever run across the same sort of issue, you have to be very conscious of what's going on. Very conscious of which primers came out. Keep those separate. Where the powder came, make sure it's being weighed as it comes out. Before you even take them apart, get all of the measurements on these things. Make sure everything's going to go back the same, so it performs the same. So as it turns out, that was the ammunition that I was shooting when I did that one day out at Front Sight to get my my rifle really dialed in for the first day of the precision rifle class. And it's also the stuff I used at the Appleseed Project. And it worked really well. I was happy with the performance. Everything went fine. All right, guys, stay tuned. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio. Nothing against you, surely I will soon. This place for all peace, soon I can end out of tonight. Take me back inside when the time is right.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong, and this is not where you belong.
Okay, guys, think of ammunition storage also similar to food storage. It's got a bit of a shelf life. Now, the shelf life of ammunition is longer than the shelf life of food, but you also need to make sure that it is clearly labeled for you or anybody else that you might allow to get to your ammunition. Or if you give it away or pass on or whatever, somebody else can readily tell what it is. Having ammunition in code does nobody any good. Just label it what the hell it is. And keep it in some sort of a cataloged format that's readily understandable. So if you need it, you can just grab it and go. If you need it for an occasion of going to the range, you know, I'm going to grab it and I'm going to go. If your buddy says, hey, man, I'm headed up to the range, you want to roll? Yeah, sure, actually, I wanted to recite in my 30-06. So you can grab the gun, go to where your ammunition is stored, grab the ammunition that you're going to shoot in that odd six that you need to sight it in with, grab it and go. Okay. Now, we've talked about this before. I just want to reiterate. Whatever it is that you're going to be hunting or shooting with, sight in with the same ammunition. Now, if you just put the rifle together, maybe it's a new scope, base, and rings, you're not sure where it's hitting or whatever, go to 25 yards, get it on paper, and you can use any ammunition to get it on paper and get it close. Then when you dial it in, use the ammunition that you're going to be using that you're sighting the gun in for. All right? You don't have to use your $1.50 around stuff to get it on paper. You can use your old mil-spec stuff to get it on paper and get it close. Once you're about to do some of the finer adjustments, put the stuff in there that you're going to be hunting or shooting with and sight in with that. You can't sight in with a 155 grain bullet and you're going to end up shooting a 190 grain bullet when you go actually hunting or whatever purpose you're going to be shooting with. You got to dial it in with the same ammo. You can get it close with the other stuff, then dial it in with the right stuff. Keep everything clearly marked and also check it from time to time, because if you use the duct tape, sometimes that stuff will dry up and curl off and flake away. It's not a be-all, end-all. If you have a label, sometimes those will corrode. Sometimes stuff might drip onto a label if you've got it there and you can't read it very well anymore. So make sure that it's there. Use some sort of a permanent marker like a Sharpie. Get the thing dialed in well, and then make sure that you've got the things labeled and you check those labels. Okay, that's how you want to keep your ammunition stored. Even if it comes in a factory case, you want to make sure that that factory case is appropriately marked with your own label, with your own system. All right? That will help everybody out. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Guys, thanks for sticking around. Stay tuned for the Global Research Hour, followed by the Ernest Hancock Show, coming up next.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will Your Freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.